Good evening. James McCanny here with my science hour. It is May 14th, 2015, and do I ever have a boatload of information for tonight, the main science topic, something I didn't get in last week. I want to talk about capturing a comet and becoming eventually a moon of Jupiter and how this all works, how it plays out. But in the process, now this is a hypothetical scenario. But in the process, this comet winds through the inner solar system and on occasion, on some of its orbits, has a close encounter with both Mars and Earth at various times and keeps doing this for quite a long period of time and then eventually becomes caught up as a moon of Jupiter. Now, this is a very likely scenario, and of course, there are millions of orbital scenarios. But anyway, that's the main science topic. On with that in just a minute. On my webpage, and this I almost did as kind of a joke, and not a joke, but a serious joke. I talk to many talk show hosts all the time on the phone. We talk behind the scenes. And the consensus is that, wow, the public is just kind of like, I wouldn't say deer in the headlights, it's just like they're no longer reacting to things. It's like they're waiting for the other shoe to drop, so to speak. And so, as a result, and also it's very clear to me that the public is basically out of money. And really, I mean, I think that's a reality that I asked some people, some callers in John Moore's show one week. I said, what's the economy like out there? I want some real answers. And I really think the economy is so shot that, there's just no, of course, there's no reporting in the schmooze news. But so what I did as a result of this was I put up, and I call it the end of the world sale. And that's still up on my webpage. I was only going to run it over the weekend, last weekend, and then I got some very interesting responses to this. And so there are certain things that have enough margin that I can knock the price way down and still, make something off it. But I just wanted to kind of test the public. But what I found real interesting is that people were buying a lot of the stuff that was not on sale. So I'm not sure what that means, but the end result, though, people, I think, have a lot of their stuff prepared, and that's good. I think what we've done is really prepared the public, and that's one of the indicators that I see here. I think people are quite well prepared, with water filters and some of those just basic things that you're really going to need. And just remember that in terms of water filters, if it's got a tube that you have to connect to a water line, if it's got an electric cord, either of those, one or the other or both, it is not for emergency, because in an emergency, you're not going to have water pressure at your kitchen sink. You're not going to have water pressure in your house. You're not going to have electricity. So the only kind of filter that really is for emergency is gravity, a gravity water filter. And it's one that you can take with you. You can pick that thing up off the counter because you're using it every day in your kitchen. And that's, most emergency things are not used every day. You should be using them every day. But most emergency items that you buy, you don't use every day in your house. The water filter, the gravity feed water filter, you do. And so you're very familiar with it. And if I were to leave my house and take one thing under my arm with me, it would be my gravity filter, my gravity feed water filter. Plain and simple. I might stick some sprouting seeds in it. I just throw the water out, stick some sprouting seed, like a jar or a container or a bag of sprouting seeds, and I'd run out the door. But at any rate, the end of the world sale, I've left it up there. And just a couple things. There's the complete survival water filter package that includes the stainless steel four candle with integral arsenic fluoride filtration in the filter elements. That filter with the a 10-pack of filter elements, the pre-filter, I think it's the 2-liter little mini water filter, the complete set of books, and the pre-filter accessory set, which is additional powders, etc., for your pre-filter. By the way, that pre-filter is only available on my page. Oops, I'm running over time. I didn't want to talk that much about this. Anyway, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and check out the end of the world sale. Also, just check out the reduced pricing on the shortwave offer number 2 and then the 10-pack of water filter elements. And just to clarify something, a listener wrote in and made a comment, something about that I had a new supplier for my water filter elements. That is not the case, and I can't imagine how anybody got that idea. The whole point is that the water filter elements are now being manufactured at a new factory facility in the United States. It's the same filter, it's the same manufacturing process, it's just now under our very own control here. It's still NSF certified. It still has the fluoride, arsenic, and all the other heavy metals and pharmaceuticals removed in the filter element itself. All of that, plus all of the other styles of filters, the dome filters, the 5-inch mini filter for the personal water filters, all of those now are being produced in a factory in the United States. So this is not a new supplier. This is simply our own factory now producing these, and believe me, it's not that the other products were inferior or anything like that, but it just really helps to have all of this in-house. And so anyway, that's a major step into the future, and as I say, it's not a new supplier. It is the same product I sold before, same exact product, just the manufacturing is done now completely in the United States. Plus, just a note, I'm getting feedback from the people who are finally getting into the DVD course, DVD number 4, the Astronomy, Astrophysics, Space Science University level course, and people love this. I'm getting some good reviews from high level people, and I know it's really top notch material, something that you will not find anyplace else on the planet. A quick comment about previous shows. I think it was the April 23rd show, and then my last week's show, May 7th, where I concentrated on alternative energy and discussing the issue that large-scale installation of solar panels for the individual user at the house or other, you know, even large installations of solar panels are minor compared to the amount of power produced at the centralized power plant. And so what I've said is this is a bad, bad situation, going to get worse. The more they sell, the worse the situation will get. But one point I wanted to clarify, and of course last week I talked about who controls the voltage, and the way this is being implemented now with the Elon Musk system, et cetera, is that the centralized power company owns the control of the voltage. And that's a question that nobody seems to understand. It's just assumed that that's the way it should be. And what I pointed out is no. In a real alternative energy scenario, the voltage is not controlled by some central entity at great difficulty, and that's the whole problem. As you install more base of alternative energy, which come online and have variability, then that central power plant that controls the voltage just cannot do it. It already has a very tough time doing it based on all kinds of conditions, but they seem to manage, kind of half manage. But as soon as you bring on large scale, large amounts of alternative energy, they can't manage it. So what I have said is that you have to get rid of the centralized power companies, because as you bring more alternative energy online, they are going to become much more expensive to operate. The more alternative energy, but solar cannot replace them, And so you're left with this huge expense of a centralized power company that can't manage the voltage. And someday they're simply going to pick up the phone and call everybody who has solar panels, and they're going to say, hey, you guys can't use these anymore. I'm sorry. Sorry you bought these. Sorry you paid $10,000 to $50,000 to put these solar panels on your house, but you can't use them anymore because you're going to wreck everything because we can't manage the voltage. Well, this is a management problem. It's not a it's bad management from the get-go. But remember, they want to burn high energy content fuels forever and charge you. And true alternative energy is energy that is already coming here, either solar or wind, etc. But the wind, three-blade wind generators have been complete failures. And they're just sitting out there idle. My wing project, this is the point, is that my wing generator project, Worldwide Energy Project, can and will someday replace the full-scale centralized power companies. But it's not going to come to a head until people get enough solar base installed. And I think this is the ironic part of this, because Elon Musk's system is going to trash the central power company. And at some point, after he's sold enough solar panels, the people are going to come screaming with their hands, trying to get their hands around his neck because they've paid $10,000 to $50,000 for a solar system to put on their house of solar panels and converters and batteries and everything else. And they're going to be told that they can't use it anymore. That's when my wing generator project will come to the forefront, because it can and will replace that central power plant, and we will have distributed energy. In other words, the voltage will be controlled locally, right down the block or at your very own house. So I think it's comical that the more they resist my wing generator project, especially in the United States, the more it is going to become inevitable. I think that's rather a befitting joke for the energy industry. They've painted themselves into a corner by controlling the voltage, and there's no way out of this. If they don't control the voltage anymore, you can say goodbye to the central power company, because they've lost their control. But they will have to remain there, because that's the way the national grid system is constructed these days. Since the very beginning, since Tesla sold the technology to Westinghouse, since J.P. Morgan and the boys invested in burning high energy content fuels, this is the way it has always been. But the future, let me tell you, is going to be strange. But what we're going to see is the wing generator projects working in isolated locations around the world, and then eventually people will see that, and that's when eventually the United States will have to come online, but that'll be far in the future. But it'll come eventually. That's the short story. That's the short version. Ceres, the little minor planet Ceres, in the news again. Very interesting. Finally, NASA has released close-range photos. These were taken on May 4th. And from a distance of about 8,400 miles. So this is getting closer and closer. They say the resolution, a single pixel resolution, is about 0.8 miles. So this is still bigger. You still can't see bugs crawling around. That's saying that facetiously. But still, we're getting much better resolution, and they're starting to get a better view, but especially of the bright spots. But first, let me skip to the planet Mercury. On my webpage, the picture of the day, the center column, I think was May 6th, I put the posting up there, of the planet Mercury and bright spots on the planet Mercury. So bright spots on planets are not unusual. There's really nothing unusual, because here's what happened. Let me explain on Mercury, and then we'll go to Ceres. On Mercury, it's covered with a dark sooty material. And this is from the comet effect, evenly distributed around the surface. And so when something impacts, or when an electrical discharge occurs, when a comet comes by, it electrically discharges to the planetary surface. And you can see Mercury is scarred right along the surface, all along the surface, the pockmarks, some burned craters, etc. And you can see that some of the craters are very bright. And that's because it basically blew away that surface material and exposed the lighter subsurface material. So that's what's going on at Mercury. It looks like the same situation occurring at Ceres, the minor planet Ceres. And Ceres lives between Mars and Jupiter. It's in the asteroid belt, considered a minor planet. And I have a posting. I'm not going to repeat what the posting is on my webpage. Go there and read that. But here's the situation. Ceres is the same. Now, NASA says, oh, that soot was deposited by impacts of asteroids. But it's absurd because then it would be streaked and everything else. It's a beautifully even, uniform soot covering all over the minor planet, or in the case of Mercury, the planet Mercury. And so that's from the comet effect, the plasma discharge comet, the material that comes in and settles on the planet. So let's go back to Ceres. Some bright spots. As they got closer, they realized that the bright spots are not single bright spots, but they're many small spots. And so could that be an electrical discharge, or could it be the impact of, say, an asteroid that broke up into 50 pieces before it hit, or a streamer of asteroids or something like that that were once part of a single? Well, it's hard to say. At this point, the pictures are not clear. Of course, many people were speculating alien base, and there's no reason to jump to that conclusion yet. But one thing I can say, if there were alien bases there or remnants of advanced civilization bases there, NASA would never show you those pictures. They would be photoshopped, and so we would never know. But the end result is that I think they're natural events. I don't think they're alien bases. And so at any rate, on my webpage, though, I have discovered, and none of the NASA webpages on Ceres talk about this, I discovered an ice mountain, what I believe is ice mountain, because the composition of Ceres beneath that sooty surface is water, ice, and ice. Probably mostly ice, because if there were a lot of water, then it would be much more spherical. Ceres is not a perfectly spherical object, and so I suspect that it's mainly ice. But possibly some loose water mixed with ice at the surface, hard to say. Or possibly down beneath an ice cap, there's liquid water. Who knows? We don't. I mean, this is all kind of new, untapped ground. Maybe after looking at enough of these in the future, like the icy moons of Jupiter, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, someday we'll have a better idea about these planets. But in watching the video that NASA put out, I saw a looked like a pimple on the western limb of Ceres. As it came around, then you could see the shadow. And then you could, as the little pimple object moved around off to the eastern limb also, you could see it rise up above the horizon. But all the way along, you could see its shadow. And so at first I thought this could be a water geyser. But the end result is that no, it's not a water geyser. It looks like a solid constructed, like a volcano. And so could this be that a object passed by Ceres, a comet, discharged the electrical discharge to the planet, minor planet Ceres, and the water would, once it's molten, you have to understand that the surface pressure is of this soot material is going to push down, and that's going to force the water up. And it's the same principle as an oil well or as an artesian well, that the surface pressure forces that water through the a local opening, and then it would come up out of a central tube, spill over, freeze, and then become an ice mountain. So anyway, I named it on my webpage, I named it Gerda. Gerda is the heroine of the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale called The Snow Queen. But what I liked about this fairy tale and the idea of naming it Gerda is that in the fairy tale, a group of trolls, devilish trolls, take control of a mirror, a magical mirror, that's distorted, and it distorts everything in the world, making it look strange and unrecognizable. And so I thought, gee, that's just like NASA today and science. Everything they put out is distorted and unrecognizable, and it really makes people hate science. But NASA has also hired a group of internet trolls that promote and force, with very angrily, force this garbage tier two science onto the public. So it's very much like the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, The Snow Queen. And of course, that's the basis for the recent Disney movie Frozen, which was altered quite a bit in the Hollywood version of. And by the way, that was one of my favorite recent movies, is Frozen. I just still a kid at heart, I guess. But at any rate, okay, I'm going to move on. Lots of topics to cover tonight. This week I got an email from a listener and wanted to know about this situation, and it keeps getting published, and this time it was in a Christian magazine or scenario, I guess, trying to explain the Noah's Flood. In the situation, ringwoodite is a mineral. It contains, under pressure, about 2.6% water. This is the Earth, above Earth version of ringwoodite. And so at any rate, what they're saying is that scientists, by listening to echoes of radio signals that go down into the Earth, have determined, this is by secondary interpretation of secondary data, that 660 kilometers under the Earth's surface, and now mind you that nobody has drilled down, nobody has seen this, this is pure speculation, based on interpretation of data, that there is vast oceans, three times the amount of water, they say, down there than in the Earth's ocean. But this is pure speculation. Also, it doesn't show how this water would come out of the ringwoodite and make it to the surface without becoming superheated steam and blowing the surface all to pieces. But here's the problem. When the Earth formed, according to standard theory, not my theory, but according to standard NASA science, there was no ocean, there was no water because of the heat of formation. Every time during this, what they call early bombardment, where there is asteroids and coalescing matter colliding and smashing together to create Earth, there, every one of these minor impacts, if there were any volatiles, including water, it would have superheated it, and without an atmosphere, it would have just blown away into outer space, and it would have never accumulated. So the end result is that there could be no water, there could be no atmosphere, there could be no volatiles on Earth, benzene, low-chain, carbon, hydrocarbons, etc. And so the end result is that there wouldn't have been any water. So how did this water get into the ringwoodite 660 kilometers down during the alleged formation of the Earth? And now they're saying, oh, it could come gushing up, and that was what caused Noah's flood. And I'm just like, oh, my goodness. And so I coined a term here, preying on Christians. It was about 6 months ago. I was listening to a Saturday morning kids show. It was at a house of some people. They were listening to this on the radio, but it was NASA channel for kids, and they were trying to associate NASA Tier 2 science with the Bible, trying to convince this little Johnny, literally little Johnny, that science was commensurate with the teachings of the Bible. And it was so convoluted, I couldn't believe it. But anyway, what they found out is there's a lot of Christians in the world, and Christians, unfortunately, are some of the easiest fooled people on the planet. Just like green tree huggers, I love them all, but very easily fooled. You can say something, and they pick it up, and they run with it, and for 10 years later, they have no idea that they're being used. to promote some idea, just like the global warming that they picked up and used, and there's no truth to it at all. There's no scientific basis to it, or the now Greenpeace promoting installation of solar panels as if it's green, when it's really a terrible idea, and it's in the very best interest of the centralized power companies and the energy industry as it stands. It's in their very best interest to install tons of solar panels. Number one, it's going to soak up all of that alternative energy investment and not do anything, and it's not going to solve the problem, which is getting rid of the centralized power plant. So Greenpeace, you know, get a brain. And so, unfortunately, this article sent in by a listener to explain Noah's flood doesn't cut it. I talked many shows ago, I remember talking about Noah's flood. I also have an hour lecture on Noah's flood in my 18-hour CD lecture series that is available on the webpage. I'm talking about the Noah's flood, but basically when the water comes gushing up out of the ground and the rain has started, those are the artesian wells exploding because of the back pressure in the ground. Not too hard to understand, but basically everybody wants to say something about the Noah's flood except what it really was. 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain. And where did all the water go in the Noah's flood? Well, the oceans rose about 200 to 600 feet. That's a lot of water. And that's what happened. But it took time to run off the land. And so there was vast flooding. And, yeah, literally the vast population of the earth died. I really liked the Russell Crowe movie about Noah. Even though I didn't like the monster rock things in there, I didn't quite think that was according to the biblical records. But they did show how the Earth had a scourge, a virus, grossly overpopulated, during that time prior to the Noah's flood. So at any rate, onwards and upwards. By the way, I apologize, I have kind of a frog voice tonight. And I was on John Moore's show yesterday morning, and somebody called in and commented about it, and I said, yeah, I have a cold, a bad headache, a cold type of thing, and I said, I'm waiting for a beautiful princess to come and kiss me so I can turn from a frog into a handsome prince. But since that has not happened, I guess you have to listen to my frog voice. Okay, now this is an article also sent in by a listener, and I really appreciate people sending things in, because with as busy as I am, I don't have time to surf the internet as much as I would really like, and of course there's tons out there, so it's really valuable for me when people send things in. So this sent in by a listener, this is fosters.com, and I suspect this is relayed from another article, but be that as it may, from Durham, North Carolina, I believe, UNH, so University of New Hampshire physicist Joseph Dwyer and lightning science colleagues from the University of California at Santa Cruz and Florida Tech described the turbulent encounter and discovery in a paper to be published in Journal of Plasma Physics that they had a Gulfstream V5 aircraft, and they're flying into violent thunderstorms to take measurements. Well, lo and behold, they find anti-electrons, or they're called positrons, and so they find also gamma ray glowing, and these created a cloud around the aircraft. And so they can't figure out why this should happen. It distorts the current understanding, which they really don't have understanding, of how lightning occurs. Okay, I want to read the last paragraph here. It says, we don't understand how lightning gets started very well because we don't understand the electrical environment of thunderstorms, Dwyer said. This positron phenomenon could be telling us something new about how thunderstorms charge up and make lightning, but our finding definitely complicates things because it doesn't fit into the picture that was developing. And so what they're saying is here are the people experts in lightning, supposedly with degrees. Here's a guy, Peter T. Paul, chair of space sciences at the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. And these people are called lightning experts. Now, how can you be called a lightning expert when the thing that you're supposed to be an expert in, you don't have any clue how it works? Let me use an analogy. Say you need have a problem with your head, and you go to the doctor, and he's the brain surgeon, and he tells you, you know, we don't know much about the brain. We don't really have any idea how it works, but I'm going to take this knife, and I'm going to cut into your brain and dig around a little bit and see if we can fix you. And I think, well, I think I'll take a rain check on that one. How can people call themselves a lightning expert when they have absolutely no clue how any of this works? And the fact that they're discovering positrons, I don't find that very unusual, because we already know that above the thunderstorms, you can regularly see gamma rays. Gamma rays are above X-rays in energy in the electromagnetic spectrum. So there's visible light, there's ultraviolet A and B, then you get into X-rays, and then above X-rays are gamma rays. So it's just very high energetic radiation. I talk about this when I deal with the induced electric dipole redshift. Once you get above 1.2 MeVs of energy in a photon, they can split and create a charged pair, a positron and an electron. I'm not going to review that now. This is a complicated topic, but the charge pair production, the mass is accounted for in the conversion of mass to energy, and you create with a positron and an electron, they will join to create the X-ray, or gamma ray, depends. It's quite right on that borderline between X-rays and gamma rays. Or if the gamma ray comes close to an atomic nucleus, it splits and becomes a positron and an electron. And my induced electric dipole redshift shows how that works, that it's the induced electric dipole that splits them. You can read about this in my book. It's in the three-part comet paper. This goes back to my very early work in the 1970s, confirmed when I was at Cornell. Actually, you can show this in laboratory experiments, very simple, with just a laboratory laser and a Tesla coil. But I talk about that also in my weather book. But the point is that these people have no clue about how lightning works. I talked a couple shows ago about the lightning around volcanoes, and I went through the entire process of how the voltage gets into those plumes above volcanoes, and it's the same process as lightning in thunderclouds. And so go back if you want, listen to that. I think it was 2 weeks ago, the April 30th show, I believe, was on the volcanoes and the lightning surrounding volcanoes. Okay, so at any rate, the same thing applies. But unfortunately, this is so typical of Tier 2 science. University-level people flying around in airplanes, flying through thunderstorms, calling themselves experts, and they have absolutely no clue how lightning works. So one of my goals is to have a lightning subpage on my webpage, but given the overload of work that I already have, this may take a while to get up, but describing how lightning works is very important. We have 10,000 lightning strokes per hour around Earth, and scientists can't tell you what causes lightning. How absurd. It's a natural byproduct of my model. How lightning works, where it comes from, and ultimately the source. Like I say, listen to that April 30th show. I'm pretty sure that's the one on lightning around volcanoes, but the same story deals with lightning around thunderstorms. Just a quick mention, Hubble telescope finds massive halo around the Andromeda galaxy. And the way they did this was measuring the deficit of light coming from distant objects. In other words, the light would pass through this very sparse but still a tremendous amount of matter that's hovering around the nucleus of the Andromeda galaxy. And, of course, this once again confirms my model that the galaxy has a tremendous amount of infalling matter That's what falls in, creates the pressure around the nucleus. The two arms come shooting out opposite sides because conservation of momentum. And it's a viscosity flow problem in three dimensions. That's my galaxy paper reprinted in the three-part comet paper, which is in the appendix of the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. So you look in Appendix 1 and you'll find that galaxy paper. Also in my DVD number 4, I have it reprinted. And I go through quite a bit of analysis because DVD number 4 is dedicated to galaxies and cosmology. Okay, I wish I could talk for about a half hour on each one of these topics, but I want to get into tonight's main science topic. And I'm going to, this is a speculation, and this is total speculation, but it gives you an idea of how the solar system really works. So, and I'm so disgusted at hearing the, oh, an asteroid collided into Earth and caused the demise of the dinosaurs. First of all, we know for a fact that the dinosaurs did not die off all at once. It was not a one day, boom, adios amigo, they're all gone. The dinosaurs lived for possibly millions of years as they died off. So something was going on, but there were some major cataclysmic events that triggered their demise. And remember, they were big animals. They were big eaters. And any time you have a catastrophic situation worldwide, then the... And we know also that the Earth changed a great deal during that time because the... For example, you find in western Montana, in Wyoming, are very rich fields of dinosaur bones. Well, I'll tell you, there ain't a lot of food in those places for a dinosaur to live on. Not even one, let alone millions of them. So the Earth absolutely had a very different climate. It had different vegetation. It had a dome, a canopy of a very different atmosphere. The Earth has changed drastically since the demise of the dinosaur. That's what ushered in the age of mammals, which we eventually came out of. But anyway, what I want to do is give a celestial mechanics example. And remember, this is just an example of a mass extinction related to a comet capture in the solar system. And I'm using the dinosaurs as an example. Not saying that this is definitively what happened to the dinosaurs, but I believe that the dinosaur demise was related to a comet capture. It could have been, for example, when Mercury became a planet, or who knows. But anyway, there are definitely some major changes. We know, for example, just as an aside note, when the comet sighting spring came in close to Mars, that it drastically changed it altered the atmosphere of Mars. Mars picked up a lot of metal, and this was visible from Earth. It picked up Mars' atmosphere, it's expanded quite a bit, it grew. And did this come from just the comet? No, there was not enough material in that comet. What it did, however, was it connected electrically with Mars, and Mars turned into a comet and drew in a tremendous amount of material very quickly, which is, by the way, something I've talked about extensively in my work, is terraforming, and that if you terraform a process for terraforming, especially after a planet like Mars lost its atmosphere and oceans, is to extend a conducting cable, like a thin carbon fiber cable, you know, a million miles out to the anti-sunward side of Mars, and it would just, you put a weight out there, it would stay in orbit outside the orbit of Mars, maybe not a million miles, but, you know, 10,000, 100,000 miles, and that would begin an electrical discharge of the solar capacitor and draw in a lot of material to advance, to accelerate the terraforming, the rebuilding of the atmosphere of Mars, and then, of course, with that would be water, and rebuild the oceans. But at any rate, so here's what I'm going to do is go through a scenario. We're going to capture in the solar system a relatively small comet, possibly a little bit smaller than our moon. And this comet is going to wind its way through the solar system for a period of, let's say, a couple hundred thousand years as it forms, as it becomes bigger and grows into a moon, and then eventually it's going to become the inner moon of Jupiter, of the four Galilean moons, of Callisto, Europa, Ganymede, and then Io is the innermost moon. That's the one I'm going to show you, that it's a brand new moon, and obviously Io is a very young planetary celestial object, very volcanic, very hot. Okay, so anyway, let's do it this way. An object comes in, and let's start out with something smaller than Ceres. So something, oh, let's say 1/50th the diameter of our moon, but still a fairly healthy object. It comes in, it becomes a comet, it starts building up slowly, and it becomes, let's say, it's captured by Saturn into the solar system, so it swings in, and its orbit, let's say, at first, is not in the plane of the planets. It's kind of askew. Let's put it at 20 degrees off of the plane of the planets. In other words, Earth is already here, our moon is already here, the dinosaurs are living on Earth, and Jupiter is out there, Saturn is out there pretty much where it is now. But this comet is captured, and it flings up out of the plane of the planet, comes around and orbits inside its innermost orbit. Its closest approach to the sun is inside the orbit of Earth. And so now what happens? It starts orbiting. It starts, the tail drag starts circularizing its orbit. Energy dampening and eccentricity dampening are the two factors, I talk about this in my work, which makes the orbit shrink. The orbit becomes smaller and becomes more circularized. So as this happens, what happens? As it goes up above the plane of the planet Jupiter, that big hulk of a planet out there, or a star, it's really a small unlit star, is pulling down on this object. When it goes down below the plane of the planets, Jupiter's pulling up. So gradually, it's pulling this object into the plane of the planets. And Jupiter and Earth have similar, not exactly the same, but similar orbits. So anyway, it's working its way into the plane of the planets very slowly. Eventually, it starts to encounter Earth on some of the crossings because its orbit, in a sense, crosses Earth's orbit, but up above Earth's orbit on one side, and when it comes back down below Earth's orbit. So eventually, yes, it starts to encounter Earth. And as it gets inside of Earth's orbit, on very rare occasions, its innermost swing in towards the sun, the perihelion, is the closest point to the sun, and aphelion is the farthest point. So during perihelion, when it's right in the ecliptic plane, the same plane as Earth and Jupiter, on occasion, it lines up directly with the sun and Earth. So what happens? Boom! An amazing, powerful solar flare hits. And that's one of the first issues that starts the demise of the dinosaurs. Now, just for example, excuse me, my frog voice coming back. Just for example, I'm going to say that it takes 1,200 years, and I'm just pulling that number out of the sky, before the comet and Earth realign the second time. But in this period of time, the comet's orbit has flattened, let's say, or become more, the angle between the comet orbit and the ecliptic, the orbit of Earth and Jupiter, which are very similar around the sun, become closer aligned because of this pulling down of Jupiter and pulling up of by Jupiter of the comet as it works its way into the plane of the planets. And so this also is a process that is commensurate with the status of the solar system, that eventually all the planets align with the major player in the solar system, which is Jupiter. So do you see how this example is a very good basis for understanding capture and how these objects become members of the solar system? In this 1,200-year period, the object has grown immensely, continually growing, and now it's becoming very close to the size of the moon Io. Okay, now that it's closer to the plane of the planets and the plane of Earth's orbit around the sun, it eventually comes and has a close gravitational encounter with Earth. Now remember that this is electron beam is attaching to Earth, the electrical discharge, the comet tail engulfs Earth with poisonous gases, with hydrocarbons, with carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and literally, because it's smaller than Earth, Earth pulls a lot of that in, and it's a major pollution event. The dinosaurs are big animals. They start to falter. They don't completely die out, but one thing that happens is this comet also had a companion that was orbiting. That companion was a fairly large asteroid. That asteroid collides with Earth. So just one of the aspects of this comet is that its companion collides with Earth. And so now you add hurt, you add insult to injury, let's put it that way, and Earth is starting to take a serious beating from this comet. Yeah, the comet swings around in its orbit, and remember, this is not a collision, this is a near passage. We do not have major mountain building because this comet is not big enough. It causes some crustal shifting, it causes some volcanoes to go off, it causes some plate tectonics activity, and so the existing plates of Earth, tectonic plates, which one is also a major misnomer that somehow these plates simply wander around the surface of Earth all by themselves. No, these are induced, the juxtapositioning of these plates is induced by passing comets. And if that weren't for these comets, Earth would just be a smooth ball with no oceans, with no atmosphere, and no hydrocarbons, no volatiles. It would just be kind of a rock, and the cooling plates would just simply separate as they grew cooler on the surface, and really the Earth would be a very boring place with certainly no biological development either, because it didn't have an atmosphere. So Earth, remember though, that's the standard scenario. In my model, look at Venus. Venus being a young comet planet forming only over the past 4 to 10,000 years, that it already has an atmosphere complete with oxygen, hydrogen, locked in other other compounds, and eventually Venus would become a water planet with carbon, nitrogen, oxygen atmosphere. But that's going to take a very long time as the chemical cooling of the planet occurs over possibly the next half billion years. So Venus, being a very young planet, already has its vast atmosphere, and that's part of the comet process. And so this object that's becoming Io is too small. It doesn't have enough surface gravity to hold an atmosphere like Venus did. But it's growing, it's depositing that material, a lot of sulfur dioxide, because remember, this is passing also as it passes in through the inner solar system, then it passes out almost to the orbit of Saturn and crossing the orbit of Jupiter, where there's a tremendous amount of sulfur dioxide. So a main component of the constituency of this comet forming is sulfur dioxide. Okay, and that means that as it passes in through past Earth, it's connecting electrically out to that region of Jupiter, and so Earth is becoming acidified. And this, once again, this is a part of the demise of the dinosaurs. And so you can see that over possibly a 10,000-year period, as this comet is forming, that is becoming, working its way in through the solar system, that it's poisoning Earth. And so the dinosaurs are dying off. The Earth is changing. The atmospheric structure of the Earth is changing. A lot of the plant life is changing. And all of a sudden, the small critters, the mammals, which have a bit more intelligence, that live in caves, etc., live in the ground, are starting to emerge as the dominant species, because the big ones, the dinosaurs, there's not enough life support on planet Earth to sustain them. And so, eventually Earth is going to have some pole shifts due to other major encounters over the upcoming 65 million years. Earth is going to have probably two or three pole shifts because of close approaches from very large passing comets. Okay, so anyway, this is the end result. Now, let's watch this comet. Eventually, it swings out and starts, on occasion, encountering the gravitational field of Jupiter, which pulls it in, starts to pull it into the orbit of Jupiter, eventually nestling into a trapped orbit around Jupiter. Now, it no longer is going to bother Earth. It's a comet orbit that's orbiting Jupiter. The tail drag is causing it to circularize and diminish its orbit, eccentricity damping and reduction in orbital energy, and so it's falling in. It starts to encounter the other three existing Galilean moons of Jupiter, Europa, Callisto, and Ganymede, and starts to interact with those, eventually working in to the innermost moon position of Jupiter, where it starts to live its life as a young moon, the other three moons being very much older, already solidifying as icy objects, very high ice content. But now Io has a very high sulfur content. It continues to discharge the capacitor which Jupiter provides, Jupiter being a young star but unlit, but still producing minor amounts of fusion in its atmosphere and producing a proton wind, which Io, the moon, is discharging. So now, really, it's living in the environment of Jupiter. The sun is having its effect on Io, but Jupiter is the dominant factor, both gravitationally and as far as the proton-supported capacitor of Jupiter. The Io is circling in, and as we find it today, it has a fairly significant comet tail of sulfur dioxide, and it's still building up. Now, the standard theory says that the sulfur dioxide ring that's associated with Io is due to sputtering off the surface of Io, but it's, as with most of the standard theories, it's backwards. The tail material is being drawn into the moon Io, and it's drawn into a circular orbit because it's the material is basically following Io in its orbit. Remember that Io moves very quickly, and so the comet tail really doesn't have the ability to stretch out in a typical comet tail. It's being dragged around behind Io because of its very rapid motion and into a ring. Now, also it interacts with Jupiter's magnetic field, and it continues to actually drive Jupiter's magnetic field because of its electrical charging, the discharge of the Jupiter capacitor, and it every now and then it discharges to the planet Jupiter. And this is, there's a torus, there's an electrical connection that was measured by the Voyager spacecraft, and this is the condition that we find Io today. Now, this is a scenario that could explain, and I'm not saying that Io was the cause of the demise of the dinosaurs, I'm just saying that this kind of scenario of a comet capture is much more plausible as the demise of the dinosaurs, because it doesn't occur over a single period of one event. There are many events that build up over time. And also, there's the possibility that a companion crashes into Earth. And there could be a possibility that an independent asteroid collided with Earth, but these are happening all the time. As far as the idea that an asteroid collided with Earth and caused the death of the dinosaurs, there have been studies done in that region off of the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, where they say this asteroid allegedly hit, that showed that the dinosaur population, even locally, did not die off. And so now they're grasping at straws. They're saying, like I announced on last week's show, that they're saying, oh, well, this asteroid hit there but caused reverberation, a kind of a ringing of the Earth's crust, and caused lava flows in India. And then that was the cause of the demise of the dinosaurs. But it still doesn't tell you everything that happened. There was definitely an atmospheric change when the dinosaurs went under, etc. This would be the result of a passing comet, and probably many occasions. This is one thing also that you could easily call that a Planet X type of object. Planet X objects don't always collide with Earth, so there's a lot of misinformation people have just because they don't understand basic celestial mechanics and how these orbital dynamics work. But at any rate, that's why I gave this example tonight, to kind of give an example, a real-life working example of how a comet can come into the solar system, do on recurring orbits, on successive orbits, create some damaging situations with Earth, and cause some serious problems. Could this happen to us today? Absolutely. We've had examples of, I must have hundreds, if not thousands, of examples now of comets that come in and directly affect the sun. And, of course, standard astronomy refuses to acknowledge it. That up till a while, they would say, oh, just coincidence, until it became too obvious that they don't even say it anymore. They don't even say, oh, that was coincidence again for the thousandth time. Clearly, I've been right about this all along, the interaction of comets, the fact that comets attract the material in the tail, and now you have to divide also the comets into groups, very small ones that don't have enough surface gravity to hold a lot of material, so a lot of that material blows off in the solar wind as neutrals. The medium-sized comets, which do build up, they have enough gravity to hold surface material, kind of like Ceres, but they don't have enough surface gravity to hold an atmosphere. And then there's the big ones, like Venus, that become a full-blown planet, complete with atmosphere, etc. Okay, well, I'm running out of time here. Remember, go and visit the webpage, jmccsci.com, and go check out the end-of-the-world sale, as I call it. Tremendously reduced prices on some of the major ticket items there. They're marked in red, the prices, and it's very visible. There also has 10% on a lot of the items, 10%, and the 10% prices are in black. The end of the world sale prices are in red. So once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.